Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Chapter 8 of The Two Brothers by Honoré de Balzac, translated by Catherine Prescott Wormley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bruce Perry. While Joseph and Madame Bridau were journeying from Orléans to Issoudun, the Knights of Idleness perpetrated one of their best tricks. An old Spaniard, a former prisoner of war, who after the peace had remained in the neighborhood where he did a small business in grain, came early one morning to market, leaving his empty cart at the foot of the tower of Issoudun. Maxence, who arrived at a rendezvous of the knights, appointed on that occasion at the foot of the tower, was soon assailed with the whispered question, "What are we to do tonight?" "Here's Père Fario's cart," he answered. "I nearly cracked my shins over it. Let us get it up on the embankment of the tower in the first place, and we'll make up our minds afterwards." When Richard Coeur de Lion built the tower of Issoudun, he raised it, as we have said, on the ruins of the basilica, which itself stood above the Roman temple and the Celtic dun. These ruins, each of which represents a period of several centuries, form a mound big with the monuments of three distinct ages. The tower is, therefore, the apex of a cone, from which the descent is equally steep on all sides, and which is only approached by a series of steps. To give in a few words an idea of the height of this tower, we may compare it to the obelisk of Luxor on its pedestal. The pedestal of the tower of Issoudun, which hid within its breast such archaeological treasures, was 80 feet high on the side towards the town. In an hour, the cart was taken off its wheels and hoisted, piece by piece, to the top of the embankment at the foot of the tower itself, a work that was somewhat like that of the soldiers who carried the artillery over the pass of the Grand Saint-Bernard. The cart was then remounted on its wheels, and the knights, by this time hungry and thirsty, returned to Mère Cognette's, where they were soon seated round the table in the low room, laughing at the grimaces Fario would make when he came after his barrow in the morning. The knights naturally did not play such capers every night. The genius of Scannarelle, Mascarilla, and Scapin combined would not have sufficed to invent 365 pieces of mischief a year. In the first place, circumstances were not always propitious. Sometimes the moon shone clear, or the last prank had greatly irritated their betters. Then one or another of their number refused to share in some proposed outrage because a relation was involved. But if the scamps were not at Mère Cognette's every night, they always met during the day, enjoying together the legitimate pleasures of hunting or the autumn vintages and the winter skating. Among this assemblage of 20 youths, all of them at war with the social somnolence of the place, there are some who were more closely allied than others to Max, and who made him their idol. A character like his often fascinates other youths. The two grandsons of Madame Auchan, François Auchan and Baruch Borniche, were his henchmen. these young fellows, accepting the general opinion of the left-handed parentage of Lousteau, looked upon Max as their cousin. Max, moreover, was liberal in lending them money for their pleasures, which their grandfather Auchan refused. He took them hunting, let them see life, and exercised a much greater influence over them than their own family. They were both orphans, and were kept, although each had attained his majority, under the guardianship of Monsieur Auchan, for reasons which will be explained when Monsieur Auchan himself comes upon the scene. At this particular moment, François and Baruch, we will call them by their Christian names for the sake of clearness, were sitting, one on each side of Max, at the middle of a table that was rather ill-lighted by the fuliginous gleams of four tallow candles of 8 to the pound. A dozen to 15 bottles of various wines had just been drunk, for only 11 of the knights were present. Baruch, whose name indicates pretty clearly that Calvinism still kept some hold on Issoudun, said to Max, as the wine was beginning to unloose all tongues, "You are threatened in your stronghold." "What do you mean by that?" asked Max. "Why, my grandmother has had a letter from Madame Bridau, who is her goddaughter, saying that she and her son are coming here. My grandmother has been getting two rooms ready for them."
"What's that to me?" said Max, taking up his glass and swallowing the contents at a gulp with a comic gesture. Max was then 34 years old. A candle standing near him threw a gleam upon his soldierly face, lit up his brow, and brought out admirably his clear skin, his ardent eyes, his black and slightly curling hair, which had the brilliancy of jet. The hair grew vigorously upward from the forehead and temples, sharply defining those five black tongues which our ancestors used to call the five points. Notwithstanding this abrupt contrast of black and white, Max's face was very sweet, owing its charm to an outline like that which Raphael gave to the faces of his Madonnas, and to a well-cut mouth whose lips smiled graciously, giving an expression of countenance which Max had made distinctively his own. The rich colouring which blooms on a Berrichon cheek added still further to his look of kindly good humour. When he laughed heartily, he showed 32 teeth worthy of the mouth of a pretty woman. In height about 5 feet 6 inches, the young man was admirably well proportioned, neither too stout nor yet too thin. His hands, carefully kept, were white and rather handsome, but his feet recalled the suburb and the foot soldier of the empire. Max would certainly have made a good general of division. He had shoulders that were worth a fortune to a marshal of France, and a breast broad enough to wear all the orders of Europe. Every movement betrayed intelligence. Born with grace and charm, like nearly all the children of love, the noble blood of his real father came out in him.
"Don't you know, Max?" cried the son of a former surgeon-major named Godet, now the best doctor in the town, from the other end of the table, "that Madame Auchan's goddaughter is the sister of Rouget. If she is coming here with her son, no doubt she means to make sure of getting the property when he dies, and then good-bye to your harvest." Max frowned. Then, with a look which ran from one face to another all round the table, he watched the effect of this announcement on the minds of those present, and again replied, "What's that to me?"
"But," said François, "I should think that if old Rouget revoked his will, in case he has made one in favour of the Rabouilleuse—"
Here Max cut short his henchman's speech. "I've stopped the mouths of people who have dared to meddle with you, my dear François," he said, "and this is the way you pay your debts? You use a contemptuous nickname in speaking of a woman to whom I am known to be attached."
Max had never before said as much as this about his relations with the person to whom François had just applied a name under which she was known at Issoudun. The late prisoner at Cabrera, the major of the grenadiers of the guard, knew enough of what honour was to judge rightly as to the causes of the disesteem in which society held him. He had, therefore, never allowed anyone, no matter who, to speak to him on the subject of Mademoiselle Flore Brazier, the servant-mistress of Jean-Jacques Rouget, so energetically termed a slut by the respectable Madame Auchan. Everybody knew it was too ticklish a subject with Max ever to speak of it unless he began it, and hitherto he had never begun it. To risk his anger or irritate him was altogether too dangerous, so that even his best friends had never joked him about the Rabouilleuse. When they talked of his liaison with the girl before Major Potel and Captain Renard, with whom he lived on intimate terms, Potel would reply, "If he is the natural brother of Jean-Jacques Rouget, where else would you have him live?" "Besides, after all," added Captain Renard, "the girl is a worthless piece, and if Max does live with her, where's the harm?" After this merited snub, François could not at once catch up the thread of his ideas, but he was still less able to do so when Max said to him gently, "Go on." "Faith, no," cried François. "You needn't get angry, Max," said young Godet. "Didn't we agree to talk freely to each other at Mère Cognette's? Shouldn't we all be mortal enemies if we remembered outside what is said or thought or done here? All the town calls Flore Brazier the Rabouilleuse, and if François did happen to let the nickname slip out, is that a crime against the order of idleness?" "No," said Max, "but against our personal friendship. However, I thought better of it. I recollected we were in session, and that was why I said, 'Go on.'" A deep silence followed. The pause became so embarrassing for the whole company that Max broke it by exclaiming, "I'll go on for him." Sensation. "For all of you." Amazement. "And tell you what you are thinking." Profound sensation. "You think that Flore, the Rabouilleuse, La Brazier, the housekeeper of Père Rouget, for they call him so, that old bachelor who can never have any children, you think, I say, that that woman supplies all my wants ever since I came back to Issoudun. If I am able to throw 300 francs a month to the dogs and treat you to suppers, as I do to-night, and lend money to all of you, you think I get the gold out of Mademoiselle Flore Brazier's purse. Well, yes." Profound sensation. "Yes, 10,000 times yes. Yes, Mademoiselle Brazier is aiming straight for the old man's property." "She gets it from father to son," observed Godet in his corner. "You think," continued Max, smiling at Godet's speech, "that I intend to marry Flore when Père Rouget dies, and so this sister and her son, of whom I hear to-night for the first time, will endanger my future?" "That's just it," cried François. "That is what everyone thinks who is sitting round this table," said Baruch. "Well, don't be uneasy, friends," answered Max. "Forewarned is forearmed. Now then, I address the Knights of Idleness. If, to get rid of these Parisians, I need the help of the order, will you lend me a hand? Oh, within the limits we have marked out for our fooleries," he added hastily, perceiving a general hesitation. "Do you suppose I want to kill them, poison them? Thank God I'm not an idiot. Besides, if the Bridos succeed,
and Flora has nothing but what she stands in, I should be satisfied. Do you understand that? I love her enough to prefer her to Mademoiselle Fichet, if Mademoiselle Fichet would have me.
Mademoiselle Fichet was the richest heiress in Issoudun, and the hand of the daughter counted for much in the reported passion of the younger Gaudet for the mother. Frankness of speech is a pearl of such price that all the knights rose to their feet as one man.
"You are a fine fellow, Max."
"Well said, Max. We'll stand by you."
"A fig for the Brideaus."
"We'll bridle them."
"After all, it is only three swains to a shepherdess."
"The deuce! Père Lousteau loved Madame Rouget. Isn't it better to love a housekeeper who is not yoked?"
"If the defunct Rouget was Max's father, the affair is in the family."
"Liberty of opinion nowadays."
"Hurrah for Max! Down with all hypocrites! Here's a health to the beautiful Flore."
Such were the 11 responses, acclamations, and toasts shouted forth by the knights of idleness, and characteristic, we may remark, of their excessively relaxed morality. It is now easy to see what interest Max had in becoming their grand master. By leading the young men of the best families in their follies and amusements, and by doing them services, he meant to create a support for himself when the day for recovering his position came. He rose gracefully and waved his glass of claret, while all the others waited eagerly for the coming allocution.
"As a mark of the ill will I bear you, I wish you all a mistress who is equal to the beautiful Flore. As to this eruption of relations, I don't feel any present uneasiness, and as to the future, we'll see what comes."
"Don't let us forget Fario's cart."
"Hang it, that's safe enough," said Gaudet. "Oh, I'll engage to settle that business," cried Max. "Be in the marketplace early, all of you, and let me know when the old fellow goes for his cart."
It was striking 3:30 in the morning as the knights slipped out in silence to go to their homes, gliding close to the walls of the houses without making the least noise, shod as they were in list shoes. Max slowly returned to the Place Saint-Jean, situated in the upper part of the town, between the Porte Saint-Jean and the Porte Villette, the quarter of the rich bourgeoisie. Maxence Gilet had concealed his fears, but the news had struck home. His experience on the hulks at Cabrera had taught him a dissimulation as deep and thorough as his corruption. First, and above all else, the 40,000 francs a year from landed property which old Rouget owned was, let it be clearly understood, the constituent element of Max's passion for Flore Brazier. By his present bearing, it is easy to see how much confidence the woman had given him in the financial future she expected to obtain through the infatuation of the old bachelor. Nevertheless, the news of the arrival of the legitimate heirs was of a nature to shake Max's faith in Flore's influence. Rouget's savings, accumulated during the last 17 years, still stood in his own name, and even if the will, which Flore declared had long been made in her favour, were revoked, these savings at least might be secured by putting them in the name of Mademoiselle Brazier. "That fool of a girl never told me in all these 7 years a word about the sister and nephews," cried Max, turning from the Rue de la Marmousse into the Rue Lavenier. 750,000 francs placed with different notaries at Bourges and Vierzon and Châteauroux can't be turned into money and put into the funds in a week without everybody knowing it in this gossiping place. The most important thing is to get rid of these relations.
As soon as they are driven away, we ought to make haste to secure the property. I must think it over." Max was tired. By the help of a pass-key, he let himself into Père Rouget's house and went to bed without making any noise, saying to himself, "Tomorrow my thoughts will be clear." It is now necessary to relate where the Sultana of the Place Saint-Jean picked up the nickname of Rabouilleuse, and how she came to be the quasi-mistress of Jean-Jacques Rouget's home. As old Dr. Rouget, the father of Jean-Jacques and Madame Brideau, advanced in years, he began to perceive the non-entity of his son. He then treated him harshly, trying to break him into a routine that might serve in place of intelligence. He thus, though unconsciously, prepared him to submit to the yoke of the first tyranny that threw its halter over his head. Coming home one day from his professional round, the malignant and vicious old man came across a bewitching little girl at the edge of some fields that lay along the Avenue de Tivoli. Hearing the horse, the child sprang up from the bottom of one of the many brooks that are to be seen from the heights of Issoudun, threading the meadows like ribbons of silver on a green robe. Naiad-like, she rose suddenly on the doctor's vision, showing the loveliest virgin head that painters ever dreamed of. Old Rouget, who knew the whole countryside, did not know this miracle of beauty. The child, who was half-naked, wore a forlorn little petticoat of coarse woolen stuff woven in alternate strips of brown and white, full of holes and very ragged. A sheet of rough writing-paper, tied on by a shred of osier, served her for a hat. Beneath this paper, covered with pot-hooks and round O's, from which it derived the name of school-paper, the loveliest mass of blonde hair that ever a daughter of Eve could have desired was twisted up and held in place by a species of comb made to comb out the tails of horses. Her pretty tanned bosom and her neck, scarcely covered by a ragged fichu, which was once a madre's handkerchief, showed edges of the white skin below the exposed and sunburned parts. One end of her petticoat was drawn between the legs and fastened with a huge pin in front, giving that garment the look of a pair of bathing drawers. The feet and the legs, which could be seen through the clear water in which she stood, attracted the eye by a delicacy which was worthy of a sculptor of the Middle Ages. The charming limbs exposed to the sun had a ruddy tone that was not without beauty of its own. The neck and bosom were worthy of being wrapped in silks and cashmeres, and the nymph had blue eyes fringed with long lashes, whose glance might have made a painter or a poet fall upon his knees. The doctor, enough of an anatomist to trace the exquisite figure, recognized the loss it would be to art if the lines of such a model were destroyed by the hard toil of the fields.
"Where do you come from, little girl? I have never seen you before," said the old doctor, then 62 years of age. This scene took place in the month of September, 1799.
"I belong in Vatan," she answered.
Hearing Rouget's voice, an ill-looking man, standing at some distance in the deeper waters of the brook, raised his head.
"What are you about, Flar?" he said. "While you are talking instead of catching, the creatures will get away."
"Why have you come here from Vatan?"
continued the doctor, paying no heed to the interruption.
"I am catching crabs for my Uncle Brasier here."
Rabouiller is a Berrichon word which admirably describes the thing it is intended to express, namely, the action of troubling the water of a brook, making it boil and bubble with a branch whose end shoots spread out like a racket.
The crabs, frightened by this operation, which they do not understand, come hastily to the surface, and in their flurry rush into the net the fisher has laid for them at a little distance. Flora Brasier held her rabouilloire in her hand with the natural grace of childlike innocence.
"Has your uncle got permission to hunt crabs?"
"Hey, are not we all under a republic that is one and indivisible?" cried the uncle from his station.
"We are under a directory," said the doctor, "and I know of no law which allows a man to come from Vatan and fish in the territory of Issoudun."
Then he said to Flore,
"Have you got a mother, little one?"
"No, monsieur, and my father is in the asylum at Bourges. He went mad from a sunstroke he got in the fields."
"How much do you earn?"
5 sous a day while the season lasts. I catch 'em as far as the Brenne. In harvest time, I glean. In winter, I spin."
"You are about 12 years old?"
"Yes, monsieur."
"Do you want to come with me? You shall be well fed and well dressed, and have some pretty shoes."
"No, my niece will stay with me. I am responsible to God and man for her," said Uncle Brasier, who had come up to them. "I am her guardian, d'ye see?" The doctor kept his countenance and checked a smile which might have escaped most people at the aspect of the man. The guardian wore a peasant's hat, rotted by sun and rain, eaten like the leaves of a cabbage that has harbored several caterpillars, and mended here and there with white thread. Beneath the hat was a dark and sunken face, in which the mouth, nose, and eyes seemed 4 black spots. His forlorn jacket was a bit of patchwork, and his trousers were of crash toweling.
"I am Dr. Rouget," said that individual, "and as you are the guardian of the child, bring her to my house in the Place Saint-Jean. It will not be a bad day's work for you, nor for her either."
Without waiting for an answer, and sure that Uncle Brasier would soon appear with his pretty rabouilleuse, Dr. Rouget set spurs to his horse and returned to Issoudun. He had hardly sat down to dinner before his cook announced the arrival of the citoyen and citoyenne Brasier.
"Sit down," said the doctor to the uncle and niece.
Flore and her guardian, still barefooted, looked round the doctor's dining-room with wondering eyes, never having seen its like before. The house, which Rouget inherited from the Descoings estate, stands in the middle of the Place Saint-Jean, a so-called square, very long and very narrow, planted with a few sickly lindens. The houses in this part of town are better built than elsewhere, and that of the Descoings was one of the finest. It stands opposite to the house of Monsieur Auchan, and has 3 windows in front on the first story, and a porte-cochere on the ground floor which gives entrance to a courtyard, beyond which lies the garden. Under the archway of the porte-cochere is the door of a large hall lighted by 2 windows on the street. The kitchen is behind this hall, part of the space being used for a staircase which leads to the upper floor and to the attic above that. Beyond the kitchen is a woodshed and wash-house, a stable for 2 horses and a coach-house, over which are some little lofts for the storage of oats, hay, and straw, where, at that time, the doctor's servant slept. The hall which the little peasant and her uncle admired with such wonder is decorated with wooden carvings of the time of Louis XV, painted gray, and a handsome marble chimney-piece over which Flore beheld herself in a large mirror without any upper division, and with a carved and gilded frame. On the panelled walls of the room, from space to space, hung several pictures, the spoil of various religious houses, such as the abbeys of Deol,
Issoudun, Saint-Gilda, La Prée, Chézal-Bunois, Saint-Sulpice, and the convents of Bourges and Issoudun, which the liberality of our kings had enriched with the precious gifts of the glorious works called forth by the Renaissance. Among the pictures obtained by the Descoings and inherited by Rouget was A Holy Family by Albano, a Saint Jerome of Domenichino, a Head of Christ by Gian Bellini, a Virgin of Leonardo, a Bearing of the Cross by Titian, which formerly belonged to the Marquis de Bellabre, the one who sustained a siege and had his head cut off under Louis XIII, a Lazarus of Paul Veronese, a Marriage of the Virgin by the priest Genois, two church paintings by Rubens, a replica of a picture by Perugino, done either by Perugino himself or by Raphael, and finally two Correggios and one Andrea del Sarto. The Descoings had culled these treasures from 300 church pictures without knowing their value, and selecting them only for their good preservation. Many were not only in magnificent frames, but some were still under glass. Perhaps it was the beauty of the frames and the value of the glass that led the Descoings to retain the pictures. The furniture of the room was not wanting in the sort of luxury we prize in these days, although at that time it had no value in Issoudun. The clock, standing on a mantel shelf between two superb silver candlesticks with six branches, had an ecclesiastical splendor which revealed the hand of Boulle. The armchairs of carved oak, covered with tapestry work due to the devoted industry of women of high rank, would be treasured in these days, for each was surmounted with a crown and coat of arms. Between the windows stood a rich console, brought from some castle, on whose marble slab stood an immense china jar, in which the doctor kept his tobacco. But neither Rouget, nor his son, nor the cook, took the slightest care of all these treasures. They spat upon a hearth of exquisite delicacy, whose gilded mouldings were now green with verdigris. A handsome chandelier, partly of semi-transparent porcelain, was peppered, like the ceiling from which it hung, with black speckles, bearing witness to the immunity enjoyed by the flies. The Descoings had draped the windows with brocatelle curtains torn from the bed of some monastic prior. To the left of the entrance door stood a chest or coffer worth many thousand francs, which the doctor now used for a sideboard. "Here, Fanchette," cried Rouget to his cook, "bring two glasses and give us some of the old wine." Fanchette, a big Berrichon countrywoman, who was considered a better cook than even La Cognette, ran in to receive the order with a celerity which said much for the doctor's despotism and something also for her own curiosity. "What is an acre of vineyard worth in your parts?" asked the doctor, pouring out a glass of wine for Blasier.
300 francs in silver."
"Well, then, leave your niece here as my servant. She shall have 300 francs in wages, and as you are her guardian, you can take them."
"Every year?" exclaimed
Brazier, with his eyes as wide as saucers. "I leave that to your conscience," said the doctor. "She is an orphan. Up to 18, she has no right to what she earns."
12 to 18, that's 6 acres of vineyard," said the uncle.
"Aye, she's a pretty one, gentle as a lamb, well made and active, and obedient as a kitten. She were the light of my poor brother's eyes."
"I will pay a year in advance," observed the doctor.
"Bless me, say 2 years, and I'll leave her with you, for she'll be better off with you than with us.
My wife beats her. She can't abide her. There's none but I to stand up for her, and the little saint of a creature is as innocent as a new-born babe."
When he heard the last part of this speech, the doctor, struck by the word innocent, made a sign to the uncle and took him out into the courtyard and from thence to the garden, leaving the Rabouilleuse at the table with Fanchette and Jean-Jacques, who immediately questioned her and to whom she naively related her meeting with the doctor.
"There now, my little darling, good-bye," said Uncle Brasier, coming back and kissing Flore on the forehead. "You can well say I've made your happiness by leaving you with this kind and worthy father of the poor. You must obey him as you would me. Be a good girl and behave nicely and do everything he tells you."
"Get the room over mine ready," said the doctor to Fanchette. "Little Flore, I am sure she is worthy of the name, will sleep there in future. Tomorrow we'll send for a shoemaker and a dressmaker. Put another plate on the table. She shall keep us company."
That evening all Issoudun could talk of nothing else than the sudden appearance of the little Rabouilleuse in Dr. Rouget's house. In that region of satire, the nickname stuck to Mademoiselle Brasier before, during, and after the period of her good fortune. The doctor no doubt intended to do with Flore Brasier, in a small way, what Louis XV did in a large one with Mademoiselle de Romans, but he was too late about it. Louis XV was still young, whereas the doctor was in the flower of old age. From 12 to 14, the charming little Rabouilleuse lived a life of unmixed happiness, always well-dressed, and often much better tricked out than the richest girls in Issoudun. She sported a gold watch and jewels, given by the doctor to encourage her studies, and she had a master who taught her to read, write, and cipher. But the almost animal life of the true peasant had instilled into Flore such deep repugnance to the bitter cup of knowledge that the doctor stopped her education at that point. His intentions with regard to the child, whom he cleansed and clothed and taught and formed with a care which was all the more remarkable because he was thought to be utterly devoid of tenderness, were interpreted in a variety of ways by the cackling society of the town, whose gossip often gave rise to fatal blunders, like those relating to the birth of Agathe and that of Max. It is not easy for the community of a country town to disentangle the truth from the mass of conjecture and contradictory reports to which a single fact gives rise. The provinces insist, as in former days the politicians of the little Provence at the Tuileries insisted, on full explanations, and they usually end by knowing everything. But each person clings to the version of the event which he or she likes best, proclaims it, argues it, and considers it the only true one. In spite of the strong light cast upon people's lives by the constant spying of a little town, truth is thus often obscured, and to be recognized it needs the impartiality which historians or superior minds acquire by looking at the subject from a higher point of view.
"What do you suppose that old gorilla wants at his age with a little girl only 15 years old?" society was still saying 2 years after the arrival of the Rabouilleuse. "Ah, that's true," they answered. "His days of merrymaking are long past." "My dear fellow, the doctor is disgusted at the stupidity of his son, and he persists in hating his daughter Agathe. It may be that he has been living a decent life for the last 2 years, intending to marry little Flore. Suppose she were to give him a fine, active, strapping boy, full of life, like Max, said one of the wise heads of the town.
Bah, don't talk nonsense. After such a life as Rouget and Lousteau led from 1770 to 1787, is it likely that either of them would have children at 65 years of age? The old villain has read the scriptures, if only as a doctor, and he is doing as David did in his old age, that's all. They say that Brazier, when he is drunk, boasts in Vatan that he cheated him, cried one of those who always believed the worst of people. Good heavens, neighbor, what won't they say at Issoudun?
From 1800 to 1805, that is, for 5 years, the doctor enjoyed all the pleasures of educating Flore, without the annoyances which the ambitions and pretensions of Mademoiselle de Romans inflicted, it is said, on Louis le Bien-Aimé. The little Rabius was so satisfied when she compared the life she led at the doctor's with that she would have led at her uncle Brazier's, that she yielded, no doubt, to the exactions of her master as if she had been an Eastern slave. With due deference to the makers of idols and to philanthropists, the inhabitants of the provinces have very little idea of certain virtues, and their scruples are of a kind that is roused by self-interest, and not by any sentiment of the right or the becoming. Raised from infancy, with no prospect before them but poverty and ceaseless labor, they are led to consider anything that saves them from the hell of hunger and eternal toil as permissible, particularly if it is not contrary to any law. Exceptions to this rule are rare. Virtue, socially speaking, is the companion of a comfortable life, and comes only with education. Thus the Rabouilleuse was an object of envy to all the young peasant girls within a circuit of 10 miles, although her conduct, from a religious point of view, was supremely reprehensible. Flore, born in 1787, grew up in the midst of the Saturnalias of 1793 and 1798, whose lurid gleams penetrated these country regions, then deprived of priests and faith and altars and religious ceremonies, where marriage was nothing more than legal coupling, and revolutionary maxims left a deep impression. This was markedly the case at Issoudun, a land where, as we have seen, revolt of all kinds is traditional. In 1802, Catholic worship was scarcely re-established. The emperor found it a difficult matter to obtain priests. In 1806, many parishes all over France were still widowed. So slowly were the clergy, decimated by the scaffold, gathered together again after their violent dispersion. In 1802, therefore, nothing was likely to reproach Flore Brazier, unless it might be her conscience, and conscience was sure to be weaker than self-interest in the ward of Uncle Brazier. If, as everybody chose to suppose, the cynical doctor was compelled by his age to respect a child of 15, the Rabouilleuse was none the less considered very wide awake, a term much used in that region. Still, some persons thought she could claim a certificate of innocence from the cessation of the doctor's cares and attentions in the last 2 years of his life, during which time he showed her something more than coldness. Old Rouget had killed too many people not to know when his own end was nigh, and his notary, finding him on his deathbed, draped, as it were, in the mantle of encyclopedic philosophy, pressed him to make a provision in favor of the young girl, then 17 years old.
"So I do," he said cynically. "My death sets her at liberty."
This speech paints the nature of the old man. Covering his evil doings with witty sayings, he obtained indulgence for them in a land where wit is always applauded, especially when addressed to obvious self-interest. In those words, the notary read the concentrated hatred of a man whose calculations had been balked by nature herself, and who revenged himself upon the innocent object of an impotent love. This opinion is confirmed to some extent by the obstinate resolution of the doctor to leave nothing to the Rabouilleuses, saying with a bitter smile, when the notary again urged the subject upon him, "Her beauty will make her rich enough." End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of The Two Brothers by Honoré de Balzac, translated by Catherine Prescott Wormley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bruce Peary. Jean-Jacques Rouget did not mourn his father, though Flore Brazier did. The old doctor had made his son extremely unhappy, especially since he came of age, which happened in 1791. But he had given the little peasant girl the material pleasures which are the ideal of happiness to country folk. When Fanchette asked Flore, after the funeral, "Well, what is to become of you, now that Monsieur is dead?" Jean-Jacques's eyes lighted up, and for the first time in his life his dull face grew animated, showed feeling, and seemed to brighten under the rays of a thought. "Leave the room," he said to Fanchette, who was clearing the table. At 17, Flore retained that delicacy of feature and form, that distinction of beauty which attracted the doctor, and which women of the world know how to preserve, though it fades among the peasant girls like the flowers of the field. Nevertheless, the tendency to embonpoint which handsome country women develop when they no longer live a life of toil and hardship in the fields and in the sunshine, was already noticeable about her. Her bust had developed. The plump white shoulders were mottled on rich lines that harmoniously blended with those of the throat, already showing a few folds of flesh. But the outline of the face was still faultless, and the chin delicate. "Flore," said Jean-Jacques in a trembling voice, "you feel at home in this house?"
"Yes, Monsieur Jean."
As the heir was about to make his declaration, he felt his tongue stiffen at the recollection of the dead man just put away in his grave, and a doubt seized him as to what lengths his father's benevolence might have gone. Flore, who was quite unable even to suspect his simplicity of mind, looked at her future master and waited for a time, expecting Jean-Jacques to go on with what he was saying. But she finally left him without knowing what to think of such obstinate silence. Whatever teaching the Rabouilleuses might have received from the doctor, it was many a long day before she finally understood the character of Jean-Jacques, whose history we now present in a few words. At the death of his father, Jacques, then 37, was as timid and submissive to paternal discipline as a child of 12 years old. That timidity ought to explain his childhood, youth, and afterlife to those who are reluctant to admit the existence of such characters or such facts as this history relates, though proofs of them are, alas, common everywhere, even among princes, for Sophie Dawes was taken by the last of the Condés under worse circumstances than the Rabouilleuses. There are two species of timidity—
the timidity of the mind and the timidity of the nerves, a physical timidity and a moral timidity. The one is independent of the other. The body may fear and tremble, while the mind is calm and courageous, or vice versa. This is the key to many moral eccentricities. When the two are united in one man, that man will be a cipher all his life. Such double-sided timidity makes him what we call an imbecile. Often fine, suppressed qualities are hidden within that imbecile. To this double infirmity we may perhaps owe the lives of certain monks who lived in ecstasy. For this unfortunate moral and physical disposition is produced quite as much by the perfection of the soul and of the organs as by defects which are still unstudied. The timidity of Jean-Jacques came from a certain torpor of his faculties, which a great teacher or a great surgeon like Desplein would have roused. In him, as in the cretins, the sense of love had inherited a strength and vigor which were lacking to his mental qualities, though he had mind enough to guide him in ordinary affairs. The violence of passion, stripped of the ideal in which most young men expend it, only increased his timidity. He had never brought himself to court, as the saying is, any woman in Issoudun. Certainly no young girl or matron would make advances to a young man of mean stature, awkward and shamefaced in attitude, whose vulgar face, with its flattened features and pallid skin, making him look old before his time, was rendered still more hideous by a pair of large and prominent light green eyes. The presence of a woman stultified the poor fellow, who was driven by passion, on the one hand, as violently as the lack of ideas resulting from his education held him back, on the other. Paralyzed between these opposing forces, he had not a word to say, and feared to be spoken to, so much did he dread the obligation of replying. Desire, which usually sets free the tongue, only petrified his powers of speech. Thus it happened that Jean-Jacques Rouget was solitary and sought solitude because there alone he was at his ease. The doctor had seen, too late for remedy, the havoc wrought in his son's life by a temperament and a character of this kind. He would have been glad to get him married, but to do that, he must deliver him over to an influence that was certain to become tyrannical, and the doctor hesitated. Was it not practically giving the whole management of the property into the hands of a stranger, some unknown girl? The doctor knew how difficult it was to gain true indications of the moral character of a woman from any study of a young girl. So, while he continued to search for a daughter-in-law whose sentiments and education offered some guarantees for the future, he endeavored to push his son into the ways of avarice, meaning to give the poor fool a sort of instinct that might eventually take the place of intelligence. He trained him, in the first place, to mechanical habits of life, and instilled into him fixed ideas as to the investment of his revenues, and he spared him the chief difficulties of the management of a fortune by leaving his estates all in good order, and leased for long periods. Nevertheless, a fact which was destined to be of paramount importance in the life of the poor creature escaped the notice of the wily old doctor. Timidity is a good deal like dissimulation, and is equally secretive. Jean-Jacques was passionately in love with the Rabouilleuse. Nothing, of course, could be more natural. Flore was the only woman who lived in the bachelor's presence, the only one he could see at his ease, and at all hours he secretly contemplated her and watched her. To him, she was the light of his paternal home.
She gave him, unknown to herself, the only pleasures that brightened his youth. Far from being jealous of his father, he rejoiced in the education the old man was giving to Flora. Would it not make her all he wanted? A woman easy to win, and to whom, therefore, he need pay no court. The passion, observe, which is able to reflect, gives, even to ninnies, fools, and imbeciles, a species of intelligence, especially in youth. In the lowest human creature we find an animal instinct whose persistency resembles thought. The next day, Flore, who had been reflecting on her master's silence, waited in expectation of some momentous communication, but although he kept near her and looked at her on the sly with passionate glances, Jean-Jacques still found nothing to say. At last, when the dessert was on the table, he recommenced the scene of the night before.
"You like your life here?" he said to Flore.
"Yes, Monsieur Jean."
"Well, stay here, then."
"Thank you, Monsieur Jean."
This strange situation lasted 3 weeks. One night, when no sound broke the stillness of the house, Flora, who chanced to wake up, heard the regular breathing of human lungs outside her door, and was frightened to discover Jean-Jacques crouched like a dog on the landing.
"He loves me," she thought, "but he will get the rheumatism if he keeps up that sort of thing."
The next day, Flora looked at her master with a certain expression. This mute, almost instinctive love had touched her. She no longer thought the poor ninny so ugly, though his forehead was crowned with pimples resembling ulcers, the signs of a vitiated blood.
"You don't want to go back and live in the fields, do you?" said Jean-Jacques when they were alone.
"Why do you ask me that?" she said, looking at him.
"To know," replied Rouget, turning the color of a boiled lobster.
"Do you wish to send me back?" she asked.
"No, mademoiselle."
"Well, what is it you want to know? You have some reason."
"Yes, I want to know."
"What?"
said Flore.
"You won't tell me?"
exclaimed Rouget.
"Yes, I will, on my honor."
"Ah, that's it," returned Rouget with a frightened air. "Are you an honest girl?"
"I'll take my oath."
"Are you, truly?"
"Don't you hear me tell you so?"
"Come, are you the same as you were when your uncle brought you here, barefooted?"
"A fine question, faith," cried Flore, blushing.
The heir lowered his head and did not raise it again. Flore, amazed at such an encouraging sign from a man who had been overcome by a fear of that nature, left the room. 3 days later, at the same hour, for both seemed to regard the dessert as a field of battle, Flore spoke first and said to her master,
"Have you anything against me?"
"No, mademoiselle," he answered. "No."
A pause.
"On the contrary."
"You seemed annoyed the other day to hear I was an honest girl."
"No, I only wished to know."
A pause.
"But you would not tell me."
"On my word," she said, "I will tell you the whole truth."
"The whole truth about my father?" he asked in a strangled voice.
"Your father," she said, looking full into her master's eye, "was a worthy man. He liked a joke. What of that? There was nothing in it. But, poor dear man, it wasn't the will that was wanting. The truth is, he had some spite against you. I don't know what. And he meant, oh,
He meant you harm. Sometimes he made me laugh, but there, what of that?
Well, Flor, said the heir, taking her hand, as my father was nothing to you.
What did you suppose he was to me? She cried, as if offended by some unworthy suspicion.
Well, but just listen. He was my benefactor, that was all. Ah, he would have liked to make me his wife, but...
But, said Rouget, taking the hand which Flore had snatched away from him, if he was nothing to you, you can stay here with me, can't you?
If you wish it, she said, dropping her eyes.
No, no, if you wish it, you, exclaimed Rouget. Yes, you shall be mistress here. All that is here shall be yours. You shall take care of my property. It is almost yours now. For I love you. I have always loved you since the day you came and stood there, there, with bare feet.
Flore made no answer.
When the silence became embarrassing, Jean-Jacques had recourse to a terrible argument.
Come, he said, with visible warmth, wouldn't it be better than returning to the fields?
As you will, Monsieur Jean, she answered.
Nevertheless, in spite of her as you will, Jean-Jacques got no further. Men of his nature want certainty. The effort that they make in avowing their love is so great and costs them so much that they feel unable to go on with it. This accounts for their attachment to the first woman who accepts them. We can only guess at circumstances by results. 10 months after the death of his father, Jean-Jacques changed completely. His leaden face cleared, and his whole countenance breathed happiness. Flore exacted that he should take minute care of his person, and her own vanity was gratified in seeing him well-dressed. She always stood on the sill of the door and watched him starting for a walk until she could see him no longer. The whole town noticed these changes, which had made a new man of the bachelor.
"Have you heard the news?" people said to each other in Issoudun.
"What is it?"
"Jean-Jacques inherits everything from his father, even the Rambouilleuse."
"Don't you suppose the old doctor was wicked enough to provide a ruler for his son?"
"Rouget has got a treasure, that's certain," said everybody.
"She's a sly one. She is very handsome, and she will make him marry her."
"What luck that girl has had, to be sure."
"The luck that only comes to pretty girls."
"Ah, bah, do you believe that? Look at my uncle Borniche Hérault. You have heard of Mademoiselle Ganivet? She was as ugly as 7 capital sins, but for all that, she got 3,000 francs a year out of him."
"Yes, but that was in 1778.
Still, Rouget is making a mistake. His father left him a good 40,000 francs income, and he ought to marry Mademoiselle Hérault."
"The doctor tried to arrange it, but she would not consent. Jean-Jacques is so stupid."
"Stupid? Why, women are very happy with that style of man."
"Is your wife happy?"
Such was the sort of tattle that ran through Issoudun. If people, following the use and wont of the provinces, began by laughing at this quasi-marriage, they ended by praising Flore for devoting herself to the poor fellow. We now see how it was that Flore Brasier obtained the management of the Rouget household, from father to son, as young Godet had said. It is desirable to sketch the history of that management for the edification of old bachelors. Fanchette, the cook, was the only person in Issoudun who thought it wrong that Flore Brasier should be queen over Jean-Jacques Rouget and his home.
She protested against the immorality of the connection, and took a tone of injured virtue, the fact being that she was humiliated by having, at her age, a crab girl for a mistress, a girl who had been brought barefoot into the house. Fanchette owned 300 francs a year in the funds, for the doctor made her invest her savings in that way, and he had left her as much more in an annuity. She could, therefore, live at her ease without the necessity of working, and she quitted the house 9 months after the funeral of her old master, April 15, 1806. That date may indicate to a perspicacious observer the epoch at which Flore Brazier ceased to be an honest girl. The Rabouilleuse, clever enough to foresee Fanchette's probable defection, there's nothing like the exercise of power for teaching policy, was already resolved to do without a servant. For 6 months she had studied, without seeming to do so, the culinary operations that made Fanchette a cordon bleu worthy of cooking for a doctor. In the matter of choice living, doctors are on a par with bishops. The doctor had brought Fanchette's talents to perfection. In the provinces, the lack of occupation and the monotony of existence turn all activity of mind towards the kitchen. People do not dine as luxuriously in the country as they do in Paris, but they dine better. The dishes are meditated upon and studied. In rural regions, we often find some carême in petticoats, some unrecognized genius, able to serve a simple dish of haricot beans worthy of the nod with which Rossini welcomed a perfectly rendered measure. When studying for his degree in Paris, the doctor had followed a course of chemistry under Rouelle, and had gathered some ideas which he afterwards put to use in the chemistry of cooking. His memory is famous in Issoudun for certain improvements little known outside of Berry. It was he who discovered that an omelette is far more delicate when the whites and the yolks are not beaten together with the violence which cooks usually put into the operation. He considered that the whites should be beaten to a froth, and the yolks gently added by degrees. Moreover, a frying pan should never be used, but a cagnard of porcelain or earthenware. The cagnard is a species of thick dish standing on 4 feet, so that when it is placed on the stove, the air circulates underneath and prevents the fire from cracking it. In Touraine, the cagnard is called a cauchemar. Rabelais, I think, speaks of a cauchemar for cooking cockatrice eggs, thus proving the antiquity of the utensil. The doctor had also found a way to prevent the tartness of browned butter, but his secret, which unluckily he kept to his own kitchen, has been lost. Flore, a born fryer and roaster, two qualities that can never be acquired by observation nor yet by labor, soon surpassed Fanchette. In making herself a cordon bleu, she was thinking of Jean-Jacques' comfort, though she was, it must be owned, tolerably dainty. Incapable, like all persons without education, of doing anything with her brains, she spent her activity upon household matters. She rubbed up the furniture till it shone, and kept everything about the house in a state of cleanliness worthy of Holland. She managed the avalanches of soiled linen and the floods of water that go by the name of the wash, which was done, according to provincial usage, 3 times a year. She kept a housewifely eye to the linen and mended it carefully. Then, desirous of learning little by little the secret of the family property, she acquired the very limited business knowledge which Rouget possessed, and increased it by conversations with the notary of the late doctor, Monsieur Aillon. Thus instructed, she gave excellent advice to her little Jean-Jacques.
sure of being always mistress, she was as eager and solicitous about the old bachelor's interests as if they had been her own. She was not obliged to guard against the exactions of her uncle, for 2 months before the doctor's death, Brazier died of a fall as he was leaving a wine shop, where, since his rise in fortune, he spent most of his time. Flora had also lost her father. Thus she served her master with all the affection which an orphan, thankful to make herself a home and a settlement in life, would naturally feel. This period of his life was paradise to poor Jean-Jacques, who now acquired the gentle habits of an animal, trained into a sort of monastic regularity. He slept late. Flore, who was up at daybreak attending to her housekeeping, woke him so that he should find his breakfast ready as soon as he had finished dressing. After breakfast, about 11 o'clock, Jean-Jacques went to walk, talked with the people he met, and came home at 3 in the afternoon to read the papers, those of the department and a journal from Paris which he received 3 days after publication, well greased by the 30 hands through which it came, browned by the stuffy noses that had pored over it, and soiled by the various tables on which it had lain. The old bachelor thus got through the day until it was time for dinner. Over that meal he spent as much time as it was possible to give it. Flore told him the news of the town, repeating the cackle that was current, which she had carefully picked up. Towards 8 o'clock the lights were put out. Going to bed early is a saving of fire and candles very commonly practised in the provinces, which contributes, no doubt, to the empty-mindedness of the inhabitants. Too much sleep dulls and weakens the brain. Such was the life of these two persons during a period of 9 years, the great events of which were a few journeys to Bourges, Vierzon, Châteauroux, or somewhat further, if the notaries of those towns and Monsieur Rion had no investments ready for acceptance. Rouget lent his money at 5% on a first mortgage, with release of the wife's rights in case the owner was married. He never lent more than a third of the value of the property, and required notes payable to his order for an additional interest of 2.5% spread over the whole duration of the loan. Such were the rules his father had told him to follow. Usury, that clog upon the ambition of the peasantry, is the destroyer of country regions. This levy of 7.5% seemed, therefore, so reasonable to the borrowers that Jean-Jacques Rouget had his choice of investments, and the notaries of the different towns, who got a fine commission for themselves from clients for whom they obtained money on such good terms, gave due notice to the old bachelor. During these 9 years, Flore obtained, in the long run, insensibly and without aiming for it, an absolute control over her master. From the first, she treated him very familiarly. Then, without failing him in proper respect, she so far surpassed him in superiority of mind and force of character that he became, in fact, the servant of his servant. Elderly child that he was, he met this mastery halfway by letting Flore take such care of him that she treated him more as a mother would a son, and he himself ended by clinging to her with the feeling of a child dependent on a mother's protection. But there were other ties between them not less tightly knotted. In the first place, Flore kept the house and managed all its business. Jean-Jacques left everything to the crab girl so completely that life without her would have seemed to him not only difficult but impossible. In every way, this woman had become the one need of his existence. She indulged all his fancies, for she knew them well.
He loved to see her bright face always smiling at him, the only face that had ever smiled upon him, the only one to which he could look for a smile. This happiness, a purely material happiness, expressed in the homely words which come readiest to the tongue in a Berrichon household, and visible on the fine countenance of the young woman, was like a reflection of his own inward content. The state into which Jean-Jacques was thrown when Flore's brightness was clouded over by some passing annoyance revealed to the girl her power over him, and to make sure of it, she sometimes liked to use it. Using such power means, with women of her class, abusing it. The Rabouilleuse, no doubt, made her master play some of those scenes buried in the mysteries of private life, of which Otway gives a specimen in the tragedy of Venice Preserved, where the scene between the senator and Aquilina is the realization of the magnificently horrible. Flore felt so secure of her power that, unfortunately for her and for the bachelor himself, it did not occur to her to make him marry her. Towards the close of 1815, Flore, who was then 27, had reached the perfect development of her beauty. Plump and fresh and white as a Norman countrywoman, she was the ideal of what our ancestors used to call a buxom housewife. Her beauty, always that of a handsome barmaid, though higher in type and better kept, gave her a likeness to Mademoiselle Georges in her palmy days, setting aside the latter's imperial dignity. Flore had the dazzling white round arms, the ample modelling, the satiny textures of the skin, the alluring, though slightly less rigidly correct outlines of the great actress. Her expression was one of sweetness and tenderness, but her glance commanded less respect than that of the noblest Agrippina that ever trod the French stage since the days of Racine. On the contrary, it evoked a vulgar joy. In 1816, the Rabouilleuse saw Maxence Gillet and fell in love with him at first sight. Her heart was cleft by the mythological arrow, admirable description of an effect of nature which the Greeks, unable to conceive the chivalric ideal and melancholy love begotten of Christianity, could represent in no other way. Flore was too handsome to be disdained, and Max accepted his conquest. Thus, at 28 years of age, the Rabouilleuse felt for the first time a true love, an idolatrous love, the love which includes all ways of loving, that of Gulnare and that of Medora. As soon as the penniless officer found out the respective situations of Flore and Jean-Jacques Rouget, he saw something more desirable than an amourette in an intimacy with the Rabouilleuse. He asked nothing better for his future prosperity than to take up his abode at the Rouget's, recognizing perfectly the feeble nature of the old bachelor. Flore's passion necessarily affected the life and household affairs of her master. For a month, the old man, now grown excessively timid, saw the laughing and kindly face of his mistress change to something terrible and gloomy and sullen. He was made to endure flashes of angry temper purposely displayed, precisely like a married man whose wife is meditating an infidelity. When, after some cruel rebuff, he nerved himself to ask Flore the reason of the change, her eyes were so full of hatred and her voice so aggressive and contemptuous that the poor creature quailed under them.
"Good heavens," she cried, "you have neither heart nor soul. Here's 16 years that I have spent my youth in this house, and I have only just found out that you have got a stone there," striking her breast. "For 2 months you have seen before your eyes that brave captain, a victim of the Bourbons, who was cut out for a general, and is down in the depths of poverty, hunted into a hole of a place where there's no way to make a penny of money. He's forced to sit on a stool all day in the mayor's office to earn, what, 600 miserable francs, a fine thing indeed. And here are you, with 659,000 well invested, and 60,000 francs income, thanks to me, who never spend more than 3,000 a year, everything included, even my own clothes. Yes, everything. And you never think of offering him a home here, though there's the second floor empty. You'd rather the rats and mice ran riot in it than put a human being there. And he, a lad your father always allowed to be his own son. Do you want to know what you are? I'll tell you. A fratricide. And I know why, too. You see I take an interest in him, and that provokes you. Stupid as you seem, you have got more spite in you than the spitefulest of men. Well, yes, I do take an interest in him, and a keen one. But Flore, indeed, what's that got to do with it? You may go and find another Flore, if you can, for I hope this glass of wine may poison me if I don't get away from your dungeon of a house. I haven't, God be thanked, cost you one penny during the 12 years I've been with you, and you have had the pleasure of my company into the bargain. I could have earned my own living anywhere with the work that I've done here, washing, ironing, looking after the linen, going to market, cooking, taking care of your interests before everything, slaving myself to death from morning till night, and this is my reward. But, Flore, oh, yes, Flore, find another Flore, if you can, at your time of life, 51 years old and getting feeble, for the way your health is failing is frightful, I know that, and besides, you are none too amusing. But, Flore, let me alone.
She went out, slamming the door with a violence that echoed through the house and seemed to shake it to its foundations. Jean-Jacques softly opened the door and went, still more softly, into the kitchen where she was muttering to herself.
"But, Flore," said the poor sheep, "this is the first time I have heard of this wish of yours. How do you know whether I will agree to it or not?" "In the first place," she said, "there ought to be a man in the house. Everybody knows you have 10, 15, 20,000 francs here. If they came to rob you, we should both be murdered. For my part, I don't care to wake up some fine morning chopped in quarters, as happened to that poor servant girl who was silly enough to defend her master. Well, if the robbers knew there was a man in the house as brave as Caesar and who wasn't born yesterday, for Max could swallow 3 burglars as quick as a flash, well, then I should sleep easy. People may tell you a lot of stuff, that I love him, that I adore him, and some say this and some say that. Do you know what you ought to say? You ought to answer that you know it, that your father told you on his deathbed to take care of his poor Max. That will stop people's tongues, for every stone in Issedun can tell you he paid Max's schooling. And so, here's 9 years that I have eaten your bread. Flore, Flore! And many a one in this town has paid court to me, I can tell you. Gold chains here and watches there, what don't they offer me? My little Flore, they say, why won't you leave that old fool of a Rouget, for that's what they call you? I leave him, I always answer, a poor innocent like that. I think I see myself, what would become of him? No, no, where the kid is tethered, let her browse.
Yes, Flore, I've none but you in this world, and you make me happy. If it will give you pleasure, my dear, well, we will have Maxence Gilet here. He can eat with us.
Heavens, I should hope so.
There, don't get angry.
Enough for one is enough for two, she answered, laughing. I'll tell you what you can do, my lamb, if you really mean to be kind. You must go and walk up and down near the mayor's office at 4 o'clock, and manage to meet Monsieur Gilet, and invite him to dinner. If he makes excuses, tell him it will give me pleasure. He is too polite to refuse. And after dinner, at dessert, if he tells you about his misfortunes and the hulks and so forth, for you can easily get him to talk about all that, then you can make him the offer to come and live here. If he makes any objection, never mind. I shall know how to settle it.
Walking slowly along the Boulevard Baron, the old celibate reflected, as much as he had the mind to reflect, over this incident. If he were to part from Flore, the mere thought confused him. Where could he find another woman? Should he marry? At his age he should be married for his money, and a legitimate wife would use him far more cruelly than Flore. Besides, the thought of being deprived of her tenderness, even if it were a mere pretense, caused him horrible anguish. He was, therefore, as polite to Captain Gilet as he knew how to be. The invitation was given, as Flore had requested, before witnesses, to guard the hero's honour from all suspicion. A reconciliation took place between Flore and her master, but from that day forth Jean-Jacques noticed many a trifle that betokened a total change in his mistress's affections. For 2 or 3 weeks Flore Brazier complained to the tradespeople in the markets and to the women with whom she gossiped about Monsieur Rouget's tyranny, how he had taken it into his head to invite his self-styled natural brother to live with him. No one, however, was taken in by this comedy, and Flore was looked upon as a wonderfully clever and artful creature. Old Rouget really found himself very comfortable after Max became the master of his house, for he thus gained a companion who paid him many attentions, without, however, showing any servility. Gilet talked, discussed politics, and sometimes went to walk with Rouget. After Max was fairly installed, Flore did not choose to do the cooking. She said it spoiled her hands. At the request of the Grand Master of the Order of the Knights of Idleness, Mère Cognette produced one of her relatives, an old maid whose master, a curate, had lately died without leaving her anything, an excellent cook withal, who declared she would devote herself for life or death to Max and Flore. In the name of the two powers, Mère Cognette promised her an annuity of 300 francs a year at the end of 10 years, if she served them loyally, honestly, and discreetly. The Védie, as she was called, was noticeable for a face deeply pitted by the smallpox and correspondingly ugly. After the new cook had entered upon her duties, the Rabouilleuse took the title of Madame Brazier. She wore corsets. She had silk or handsome woolen and cotton dresses according to the season, expensive neckerchiefs, embroidered caps and collars, lace ruffles at her throat, boots instead of shoes, and altogether adopted a richness and elegance of apparel which renewed the youthfulness of her appearance. She was like a rough diamond that needed cutting and mounting by a jeweller to bring out its full value. Her desire was to do honour to Max. At the end of the first year, in 1817, she brought a horse
styled English, from Bourges for the poor cavalry captain, who was weary of going afoot. Max had picked up in the purlieus of Issoudun an old lancer of the Imperial Guard, a Pole named Kowski, now very poor, who asked nothing better than to quarter himself in Monsieur Rouget's house as the captain's servant. Max was Kowski's idol, especially after the duel with the three royalists. So, from 1817, the household of the old bachelor was made up of five persons, three of whom were masters, and the expenses advanced to about 8,000 francs a year. End of chapter 9.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.